Welcome to the Good Grief Conversation. I'm your host, Janet Jones, and you're listening to UK Health Radio. This programme brings you honest, gritty, emotional and inspiring conversation around a subject that affects all of us, yet is still very much taboo. So join me now for this inspiring Good Grief Conversation. And welcome to the Good Grief Conversation. This afternoon, I am having a very close and personal conversation with a very dear friend of mine, Teo Akinbody. We've been friends for over 30 years, and I do recall him losing his parents as a young boy. And I discovered, when I lost my son Murray, I discovered that he also had lost his brother when he was a young boy too. So in today's conversation, we're going to have a very heartfelt conversation and open and learning to understand what it is like to experience that level of grief and to come out as amazing as this guy did. Enjoy this conversation. This man is beautiful. So thank you for joining me on the Good Grief Conversation, Teo. We go back a very long way, in fact.
We certainly do.
All the way back to the Royal Exchange back in the 80s, the early 80s, in fact. You were an usher then.
I did many jobs at the Royal Exchange.
You did.
And usher was one of them, yeah.
But you're not an usher anymore. You are now a musician. And not only are you a musician, you are the composer of the Good Grief Conversation theme tune.
I am, yeah.
You must put that on your CV.
Yeah, in fact, I should do. I really should.
And the other things that you've done are, of course, working for the RSC and TV, radio, all kinds of things. You've moved on.
Yeah, I've been around a little bit, quite a bit over the years. I've been very, very lucky. Very lucky to have met some wonderful people along the way and to have had all sorts of amazing opportunities be presented to me that I've taken.
Yeah, you have. But that also comes from you being such a great guy, you know. People know you for being a great guy with a great smile. But the conversation we're going to have today shows that, you know, what's behind that great guy and that great smile. So you want to tell me a little about, you know, the grief that has been a part of your life, and we can talk about where it's gone to as we go.
Well, yeah, I had quite a challenging start to my life. There's the long version, there's a short version, but essentially I was born in London. My family from Nigeria, and they came over in the 50s and had three children. I was the baby of the family.
So am I as well, you know, so maybe why we connect.
Yeah, that was a baby. Exactly. There must be something in that. So I grew up in the 60s in London. It was an interesting upbringing in that I didn't speak Yoruba. That's the tribe that my family are from, and that's the language they speak. They taught us English because they didn't want us to be confused, and that they thought we would be confused if we spoke two languages. Now I see it as a pity, really, because I wish I could speak Yoruba. So it was a fairly happy childhood up until, I guess, about the age of seven. That's when it all started to change. So my dad had been ill for a while. I didn't know what he was ill with, but he was in and out of hospital. And then in the final part of his life, he was in hospital for quite a few months. And so when I was seven, and he was quite young, he was 45, he died of bowel cancer. At the time, I don't know why, I thought it was stomach cancer. I'm sure they told me it was stomach cancer. I only found out relatively recently it was bowel cancer. So yeah, so that was, he was quite young. We were all quite young. So that was in 68. So I remember the first thought that came into my head when my dad died. The first thought was that, oh, I'm halfway to being an orphan. I don't know why that thought came into my head, but I remember it to this very day. It just straight into my head.
Amazing, isn't it? And we wonder sometimes where those kind of random thoughts even come from, but they seem to drop
in. Yeah, they do. It wasn't like I knew lots of orphans or anything like that. In fact, I don't think I knew any. So obviously that sort of thing was kind of, you know, rife in literature, Oliver and, you know, all those kind of things. So yeah, and the concept of the orphan, obviously we all know about that.
And also, I guess age 7, that is the age where children are becoming very conscious of their parents and, you know, and life really. And they'll have heard at that point of, you know, people dying and stuff. So we're just becoming more aware at the age of 7. So maybe it was an awareness that made you think that.
Possibly. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was an awareness. Maybe it was a foresight. Who can say?
Who can say? Yes. Yeah, maybe it was.
Anyway, so then followed three good years. My mum was amazing. My mum was an amazing woman. She was a sort of sunny woman. She was a nurse. She worked really, really hard. And she just worked really, really hard for 3 children. I know I have strong memories of her just always working. She was a nurse and a district nurse. And I remember once a week, she used to have to go to the clinic and do an evening session at the clinic. And every now and then she'd take me with her. And I remember the biggest treat about going to that clinic was stationery.
It was stationery
covered. I used to come out with pens and pencils and rubbers. That was a big treat for a 7-year-old in those days. maybe it still is. And actually, my daughter was quite into stationery. Yeah. Anyway, so 3 years with my mum. So it was a Friday night, and me and my brother was 5 years older than me. My sister was 6 years older than me. So by this time, I was 10, brother 15, sister 16. And we were watching telly on a Friday night. And my brother went into the kitchen to get a drink or something. And I just heard a scream. I just remember a scream. So me and my sister ran off to see what happened. And my mum had collapsed. She collapsed in the kitchen. It turned out that it was a stroke. So she couldn't get up. She wasn't a small woman, my mum. So she couldn't get up, and already there was some paralysis down the side of her face. I remember as well, because I remember trying to say, I'll be all right. I'm all right. I'm all right. But it was kind of slurred. So this was pretty terrifying. And I think my brother or my sister said, call uncle, because we had an uncle, Uncle Tunde, who used to hang out with us quite a lot. So I called uncle and called an ambulance. And then I sat at the top of the stairs. I couldn't go back in the kitchen. So I just sat at the top of the stairs and waiting for someone else to arrive or something to arrive. So, my uncle did arrive. An ambulance did arrive. And my mum went to hospital. She managed another week and a half. So I remember the last time I saw her was a week Saturday after she'd gone in. So it was a week and a day. And she was on pretty good form. She was kind of smiling. She was sort of holding court. I remember that we were there. There were relatives and family friends all around. And, you know, obviously she was still slurring, but she was kind of smiling and joking. And she was on really, really good form. But yeah, that was the last time I saw her. So she died the Wednesday after. So a week and a half after a stroke. I think she must have had another stroke. And so then I was an orphan.
At 10 years old?
Yeah. At 10 years old, I was 10, brother 15, sister 16. Yeah.
That's really young to become an orphan. And what did that do for you? Can you remember how you felt when you were 10, you know, to have lost both parents now? How did you feel?
It was very different to my dad. Yeah, it was quite different to my dad. I was close to my dad, but not as close as I was to my mum. I mean, it's kind of the Nigerian way, really. At least it certainly was in those days, that, you know, the women carried more responsibility for the bringing up the kids, and then, you know, kind of dads were there and played, but kind of did their thing. I mean, Now, this was the 60s/70s. So, I mean, it's not just a Nigerian thing, really, was it? Let's face it, in those days.
It wasn't just a Nigerian thing. No. But also, I think at that age, children are closer to their mother, especially boys at that age. You were probably just approaching the age where you were about to kind of look to your father for guidance and the moving away from the mother at that time.
Possibly. I couldn't say, but what I do know is that I was a classic mummy's boy.
I bet you were.
I was such a mummy's boy, clinging to my mum's side. Like, my mum was everything. So, losing my mum was as devastating as you can imagine, really. Yeah. And I remember being deeply, deeply sad for a long time. It was a little complicated what was going to happen to us after that. So my mum was the oldest, but there were brothers and sisters. My mum did have brothers and sisters in London as well. So the responsibility for us, or our care, went to my uncle, who was the next one down from my mum. So the next oldest. Although it was a little complicated at the time, because I was close to my mum's side and I knew my mum's side of family. Didn't really know my dad's side of the family for a while. But there was a sister. My dad did have a sister. It was an auntie who I had met when I went on holiday to Nigeria before then. It was quite a severe woman. She ran a school. She ran a school for kids in Ibadan in Nigeria. So there was talk that we would go to Nigeria to live with Mrs. Bolaniwa, that's her name. And we were terrified by the idea of that, because we wanted. I mean, not only did we have the grief of losing our mum, so both our parents, but then there was then the possibility of going to leave the country that we'd lived all our lives and going to live in another country where people spoke a different language, where completely, yeah, didn't know. I mean, I had started learning the language by that time, actually, because my mum took us to Nigeria a year before. I loved it. I loved it there. It was a life-changing experience. But I was aware that everyone spoke a different language,
which you didn't know. Yeah.
And I thought, why don't I speak Yoruba? Mom, I want to learn. I want you to teach me Yoruba. So I did start. I'd started learning, but I hadn't gotten that far. Not really communicate. So anyway, my uncle won out.
You must have felt really vulnerable at that time to have lost both of your parents, and you must have been wondering what on earth was going to happen to you.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The uncertainty was the not knowing where we were going to go. The previous year, I suppose, had been quite an active year in that my mum had bought a house and we'd gone on holiday to Nigeria as well. So lots of stuff had happened. So we had a house in London. A house I wish I still had. I don't even like to try to imagine what that house would be worth now.
I know. I can imagine. My gosh, can you imagine? Oh, whereabouts was it to you? What part of London?
At Holloway, North London, Islington. That's another grief, the grief of the loss of the family home that I sold for next to nothing. Yeah, so we had the house. So my uncle won out, and what happened was my uncle and auntie and their two children moved into our house. And they looked after us. So that was it. At that time, my relationship with my uncle was great, actually. My relationship with my auntie, not as great. No, she was okay, but she was a bit frightening, really.
And I guess when you've had a mum who, you've clung to and obviously had lots of love from, must have been quite difficult then, having a woman in your life who isn't as warm and welcoming as your mum was.
Yeah, quite simply, she wasn't my mum. I don't know how happy she was about the idea of looking after us. She was caring. Yeah, she was caring, but she wasn't loving. And she was quite hard, really. She was quite hard. She was quite strict. There were things to which I'm very grateful for her. But my mum kind of supported us a lot. My mum did everything for us. And then suddenly, like, my auntie was there, it was chores. You do the washing up, you empty the bins, as the years went on, you cook, you clean, you do all sorts of things. It became a very strict household.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And
come in handy now as an adult, I suppose. But
as I'm very grateful to her. I mean, you know, as an adult, I learned how to look after myself. But at the time, it was really tough. It was really tough.
So going back to that little 10-year-old boy, now you've got your uncle and your auntie moved in with you and cousins as well, did you say?
Yeah, two cousins.
Yeah. So now your household is like completely, completely different. There is a chance when a young person like that becomes orphaned that you can easily lose your way, feel angry at life. You know, it's very easy at that point to go down a wrong road, isn't it? Did you feel particularly angry at life? Or, you know, I know you said you felt sad, but, you know, what other feelings did you have?
I don't remember anger, but what I do remember was I remember questioning God. My family were very religious, and, you know, we ought to pray. If you pray, good things will happen. If you're a good person, good things will happen, all this stuff. Yeah. And my dad was especially religious. I mean, especially, he was like he was kind of like a pillar of the community. Like, people used to come around, and he wasn't a priest, but, you know, he would hold prayers. People would come around and they pray. I remember in the room and lots of people praying and all the rest of it and stuff. And yeah, we went to Sunday school and all those things. I do remember a bit of a question just about, well, how comes these two really good people, like both really good people who prayed, who did the right things, but they died so young? I mean, I say so young, I mean, it wasn't that young, really. When you're 10, 45 is old. Let's face it.
Well, yes. As a 10-year-old, you thought they were old.
Yeah, they were old. I mean, they were old. They were both old. And now I know they were young, of course. At that time, I thought they were old. But whether they were old or not, it was before their time. Especially my dad had really suffered as well. He'd been really, you know, all the pain.
How old was your mum when she passed away?
40. She was 40.
So that's nothing.
So that was nothing. Yeah. So religion didn't really make as much sense to me. I carry on going to church and stuff, but yeah, questions. That's when the questions really started. And so I had two more years with my auntie and uncle, and it was difficult. I remember little things, like I remember my auntie finding my grief difficult to deal with. I remember feeling sad. Obviously, this is a long time ago. Now, I was 10, so this was 11 years ago, something like that. It was a long, long time ago. But I do remember my auntie. I remember one thing of her saying, cheer up or we'll have to send you off to Nigeria. But I remember that didn't make me cheer up. I was just sad. I was really sad. It was devastating. It was devastating.
Your world has fallen apart. You know, parents are, as a child, they're your rock, aren't they? That's like they are the center of your world. And to have both of that taken away. So your life is kind of thrown out on a spin at a very young age.
It was. But what I had was my brother and sister. At least I had them. So no matter how tough things were at home, and they did kind of get tough. And, you know, I don't want to sort of blame my auntie for this, because we became much closer later in life, actually. But it was difficult. It was difficult. So, and she found it hard to manage my grief. And I think she found it difficult to deal with my sister's sadness as well. But my brother was pretty kind of, my memory of him is that as time passed, he became his old self, which was a really kind of like lively, happy-go-lucky, easygoing lad. Lots of friends, very sociable. And he got on really well with my auntie. She really loved him. Of the three of us, he was the one she was closest to.
Yeah, and like you say, probably because your auntie couldn't handle the sadness of you and your sister. It's hard trying to tap into someone else's sadness. And I guess people don't know what to do with it, you know, and people just want you to be happy again, like now, you know, get out, break out of this sadness and do something to cheer yourself up. But grief isn't like that, though.
No, exactly. It isn't like that. People don't know, how to be with you. And I think it was especially so in those days and with children. I don't really think that children were acknowledged to have feelings, particularly in those days, really, were they? I mean, you know, and it's not, that's not just a Nigerian cultural thing. That's a general thing. It was the whole kind of, children were loved, but there was a whole, children should be seen and not heard. So cheer up, stiff up a lip, get on with it and stuff, be happy, go and play. What are you feeling about? Just go out and play with your friend. What's your problem? Just get on with it, kind of thing. That's how the older generation been brought up. I mean, it was even harder for them, wasn't it? I mean,
absolutely, yeah. And I guess, you know, people, they've come through the war, so they're strong and they're like, come on, you know, you can do this. And they want you to just, like you say, stiff up a lip and get on with it right now.
Absolutely.
But that's not the best way to heal from losing a loved one.
No, I think people are much better at talking about grief with children now. I think there's an acknowledgement that it has an impact on children. You know, I didn't watch it. I saw a trailer for a Rio Ferdinand documentary because he lost his wife and they had two young children. And then later on, he got another partner who came into their lives. And, you know, that whole dynamic was pretty challenging for them, the grief and then the new woman in their life. But they talked. And they talked, and it sounds like they're in a pretty good place now.
Yeah, it's the opportunity to be vulnerable and feel safe with your vulnerability so that somebody, the person who you're with is not either going to panic or not know what to do with your emotions and, you know, and suddenly try and patch you back up again. It's knowing that you're in this safe environment, really.
Exactly. And allowing you to be, acknowledging what you're going through and just allowing you to be. And I know there is a lot of people have the issue of trying to fix a person. Someone has a problem, fix it. You know, it's like, you know, you've lost some money. Okay, how are you going to get some more? Your car's broken. Okay, what's wrong with it? Fix it. But like with grief, it's not the same thing. It's not, there isn't a straightforward fix, is there? As in with a lot of emotional issues, there isn't an easy fix.
No, and a lot of the time, it's just having space to let the emotions out. I mean, of all the people who have been with me during my journey, you know, I remember, you know, and I'm sure you'll never forget the times when we've been together. And I always recognize that you just sat and gave me space. And you never rushed me, and you know, you sat with the pain with me without trying to make me feel better or do better or cheer up or anything. And I truly appreciate that. And that can only come from, you know, your life experience, I suppose.
It is, in that when I look at my early life, I lived with pain. I had a lot of pain and I carried it. And it didn't destroy me. It absolutely didn't destroy me. So, and I've met a lot of people with pain, because a lot of us carry pain or are in times of pain. And it is part of life, joy, pain.
And it's part of life, isn't it? We're all going to go through painful times.
Absolutely. But I do know that it makes some people uncomfortable and some people run away, but it's one thing I've never done. I've never been afraid of people with pain because I understand that. So you know, we can just be with each other and we can chat and we can talk. We can talk about it if we want to. We can not talk about it if we don't want to. We just be. I think also I've had counseling in my life, but it's one thing I learned about. The counselor was amazing and she helped me find all the answers, because all the answers were in me, and she helped me work out who I am and she helped me find answers, and she never told me what to do. She didn't try and fix me. And I think I instinctively learned from that about, I try not to tell people what to do, because that might be what's right for me, but that's not necessarily what's right for them. So maybe we help each other find the solution stuff. But I would say, Matt, you should do this or you should do that. Sometimes it might be, have you thought of doing that? But never you should do that, which is quite important to me.
No, you're right. But the answers are within all of us for our journey, I believe. For the journey that we're on as individuals, I believe we have the answers inside of us. But sometimes they're not so easy to reach or to see at that moment in time. And we do have to sit still and allow that knowledge to come out. You know, going back to that time when you helped me, that's what you gave me. You gave me the space to erupt on many occasions, you know, but safely. You know, I knew I was safe. I knew you weren't judging me. You weren't nothing like that. So I felt safe to be that. And I knew that you weren't forcing me to feel better, because that is such a pressure. You know, people can put on such a pressure on you to make you feel better, or you should be feeling better by now. And it's like, I can't control that.
No, I think sometimes people do that for themselves, because they then, if it's making them uncomfortable, then they want you to feel better, and then they will feel more comfortable.
Yeah. And then they can start talking about other things. So let's continue with your story, because we know it's not over yet.
It's not over. Well, it's not over yet. There's a...
The full story isn't over yet, but we're talking about that.
Yeah, there's another 49 years. At least. This was when I was 10. And my brother, yeah. So I was talking about my brother and my auntie. Their relationship was beautiful, actually. It was a lovely thing to see that my auntie got on so well with my brother, which is great. So 2 years later, my brother got ill. So he went to hospital for tests. And so this was, by this time I'm 12, he's 17. So it turned out that he had leukemia. I don't know if I knew it was leukemia. Maybe I did know it was leukemia, or I don't know. Anyway, I just knew he was ill. I didn't know the seriousness of his illness. I didn't know the gravity of it. I just knew he was ill. But, you know, people get ill. People come out of hospital. They get better. Like young people, like old people. Exactly. Because I mean, my experience was that old people get ill, go to hospital, and die. Yeah. But young people, yeah, they get ill and they just, you know, they come out, they grow up, they live long, and then they die.
Especially young people, yeah.
And my brother was always, he was just always still in such good spirits. He was such a jolly lad. Lost his hair, got a wig, wore a wig for a while, the funniest wig. But so he was rocking that bald head. He looked good. It was about 3 or 4 months that he lived with it. And then that summer he died, which was a huge shock. When my mum died, I had the thought of, I'm halfway to an orphan. I never thought that anything would happen to my brother. It's my big brother. So that was probably an even bigger shock than my mum dying, I would say. And because he was my big brother, I mean, I idolized him from the moment I was born.
Can imagine. And he's one of you, isn't he?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, your siblings, you're a little team, and he's your team. Whereas parents, they're kind of in another team.
We're the three acting bodies. We're the ones who are left with the other family, with the Olu family.
So the bond had been intensified beyond normal sibling relationships, hadn't it?
And even because we're the boys, even me and he are the team against my sister sometimes. I mean, my poor sister. Sometimes we'll gang up against her because she's the oldest, she's the big one. That was a huge blow.
It's massive. And I remember Lewis, you know, with losing his little brother, you know, and he said he felt he'd lost half of himself, because people always referred to them as the boys. So they're like a single unit, really. So it was always Iona and the boys. It was never Iona and Lewis and Murray. It was always the boys.
Exactly. Your children are the same setup as us three, aren't they? So
same setup, yeah. So it's a huge wrench.
Yeah, it was huge. It was absolutely huge.
So you were 12 at that time. How does little 12-year-old Teo handle that one?
By retreating into himself, I guess. A combination of things happened over the space of the year when I lost my brother. That was the summer. So later that summer, I mean, I still had my sister, but my sister turned 18. So she did as many 18-year-olds do. She went to university in the autumn. So I lost my brother and I lost my sister in a way. because my sister went away, which was so hard for her. She knew how hard it was for me at home with my auntie. Also, my uncle went to Nigeria just to kind of to work and to kind of plot the path for the family returning home, because most Nigerians in those days anyway, when they came over, it wasn't for good. It was to come over to study and some money, then to go back. And he trained as an accountant, and he'd also trained as a lawyer. So he went over to Nigeria to become a lawyer and things. And my uncle was the one who was all right. Also, a year to the day, my auntie had a baby as well, on my brother's birthday. Timmy was born, Timmy. Yeah, which was amazing.
That's uncanny, isn't it?
Yeah, it is uncanny.
Yes, of all the days of a year,
yeah,
he was born on your brother's birthday. That's amazing.
Well, that's the day he was born, which was, yeah, that was
yeah, something. There's opportunities. That's amazing.
The difficult time, it got worse. I mean, it basically got worse. It was a really tough time, just me, my auntie and the kids.
So as a little 12-year-old boy who's now pretty much lost all your family, now you could go down a wrong route.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now I could go down a wrong route. There were various routes that I thought about taking. I was 12, and I mean, I did go to a really tough school. I went to the toughest of tough schools. Back in those days, Holloway School was the school you were sent to if you were, like, applied to get into a particular school and you couldn't get in. So, oh, yeah, you'd go to that school. If you was into football, you would go to that school. And I'd applied for a different school and didn't get in. So I was terrified by the idea of going to school because it was notorious. The reputation was absolutely terrible, rock bottom. Education, it was terrible. So people at that school took all sorts of paths. The path that I most often considered taking was death. Yeah, I often thought, because I was so sad and so grief-stricken and could see no way out of this. I was really miserable at home. Not at school. I mean, yeah, at school, I was a kind of regular kid, did my stuff. I wasn't particularly bad. I wasn't particularly good. I was just a regular kid.
Well, I guess you're in public as well then, aren't you? You know, where we all have a public face.
But also, I mean, I was two people as well. I think a lot of people from immigrant communities, children who are born, second generation children, will have that thing. You are one thing at home, where you live in one culture at home and you live in a different culture outside the front door. So being used to two different cultures, I guess I was two people. But the one at home, yeah, was a pretty sad kid, pretty miserable kid. There was a pack of paracetamol that I often thought, well, I could take that. That's there. I know where it is. So that's my way out. That's my escape route. I didn't ever take them. I came close, but I didn't ever take them. I guess for a number of reasons, but maybe deep down, well, one reason was maybe deep down, I knew that life wouldn't necessarily be like that forever.
There was enough in you that gave you hope, I suppose. Even though life wasn't showing you that it was possible, there was enough in your spirit that was saying that there is hope here.
The other thing that's probably saved my life is music. In this secondary school, as I say, it was the worst secondary school. But the first year I was there, there was this amazing teacher called Mr. Hutchinson, who was one of those inspirational teachers. He ran a recorder group. So everyone got given a music test. And if you got over 50%, you're put in the choir or the recorder group. And thank goodness I was put in the recorder group. So I started learning the recorder, which when I look back on it now, it's really strange because, like, primary school kids learn the recorder. So you always see this cute little kid with these recorders playing these, like, cute little tunes and stuff. And we were these rough, tough, all-away school boys given a recorder to play. But for me, it changed my world because I'd always listened to music. I'd always loved music. We were Nigerian, so Nigerians love music. Every time there was a family occasion, every time there's a party, there's music on, there's dancing, there's Nigerian music, High Life, Juju, there's Sunny Ade, there's James Brown, there's, like, Motown, there's everything.
Making me want to go dancing now.
I know, there you go. Plus, my mum had always really been in. My mum, I think I have such an eclectic taste in music because of my mum. The first records she ever gave me. She gave me two. She didn't go out and buy them. They were like just part of the record collection. And she said, Tayo, these are yours. So one of them was a Nigerian, a Yoruba kind of pop music kind of thing. And the other one was Doris Day.
Oh, I love Doris Day.
On one side was Move Over, Darling. And on the other side was Twinkle, Twinkle. Not Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. It's Twinkle, Twinkle, Stars Up in the Sky. It was the most beautiful thing. I loved these two records. And from Doris Day to Nigerian pop music sums up everything that we listen to in the house.
And there's, because there's everything in between that, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. Beatles, jazz, James Brown, classical a bit, like everything, country.
So you learn the recorder. So
I learned the recorder as an 11-year-old, and like it's like a light shining out the sky, heavenly choir looking down on me, even though I wasn't believing God by then, because like...
That sealed the deal then.
Yeah, like when my brother died, that was it with me and religion. It's like, okay, yeah, that was it. Like there can't be an intelligent design to this life that we're all living in. You know, we watched the news and I'd seen what had gone on in Biafra. I remember seeing those children with the distended bellies and the flies over them as they were dying of starvation. And so how can you tell me there's a God when you've got those children who have done nothing to anybody, dying the most pitiful, agonizing deaths? So for me, it's like, and then my brother just put a tin hat on it. It's like, nah, it's not having that. So, but what I did believe in was music. I believe in music. I believe in people. I believe in love, and I believe in music. And this teacher, yeah, he opened the world of music to me. And I went on from one instrument to another, and I had found my thing. You know, some people live a long time before they find their thing. But I was lucky that at the age of 11, I found my thing.
And that thing saved you.
That saved me, yeah. It absolutely saved me. So music, because you can express things. I'd always felt things with music, but I think when you suffer loss as a child, it forms you. When you suffer loss as an adult, it devastates you and it affects you. But when you suffer it as a child, I think it forms you. So you grow into it. It's not necessarily a bad thing. I don't say that as necessarily a negative thing, but it forms the person you are. You grow around it. It changes your character.
It does. And I think this is at any age. Well, it depends on your life view, I suppose. But I find that it makes you more compassionate. A broken heart can often become a bigger heart. And you have a really big heart. I see that in so many places now that I think that just seems true to me. Whenever I meet somebody who's really suffered in their life, they're always like kinder and more compassionate. But then that may be the people who I meet. You know, I'm sure there are people out there that life has dealt them a rough hand and they've shut down. But certainly I see a greater amount of kindness and compassion through loss.
I can imagine how some people might take a different turn. Yeah, there are all sorts of ways that one could go, I suppose, in that, you know, life has taught me many things, because there were so many lessons in life. And my early life is, there were so many lessons in my early life. There are lessons I could have learnt. And I know for people who this is true, that when you love someone, when you really love someone, you lose them. That's a lesson I could have learnt. A lesson I learnt is that life is really short. So embrace it. Absolutely embrace it to the full. It was existentialist. I'm not very good with planning for the distant future.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yes.
I can plan for, I can look in front of me, but I can't look a long way in front of me.
No. And then maybe that has come from your childhood experiences, because you can go, you know, what's the point of wasting my time looking so far ahead? We might not get that. But what we can do is make this time around us more rich and more loving, and, you know, and do more with the time around us.
Absolutely. You know, I wake up every day and it's not a conscious thing, but it is an absolutely subconscious thing. I wake up with the feeling of I'm alive. It's another day. Okay, let's go.
I love that.
I love being alive. I really do. Life is just the most miraculous thing to me, you know, and the more I think about it, you know, human beings, wasps, bees, butterflies, birds, elephants, all incredible. And human beings are, you know, out of them all, the most incredible things. This stuff that we've done, and the way that we can communicate and have feelings and express feelings, and, you know, and create art and create technology and drive around in cars and fly in aeroplanes. I mean, it's just, it fries my brain almost. So it's just the most amazing thing. And, you know, I know that I'm lucky enough to be in a position where I can enjoy life. You know, I know for some people, you know, life is a hell of a lot tougher than mine, and it can feel really bleak. It can feel so bleak.
But the bleakness doesn't stay around forever.
It doesn't. And I know that. I know that as much as anyone, because I have had the darkest of times. I've had the times when I've reached for the paracetamol bottle, but put it back. And I'm so glad I did.
I'm so glad you did too, Teo. Teo, sweetie, we are out of time.
Oh, okay.
I've loved, what a great conversation. And to have this with my dear friend, this has been a gift. Teo.
Oh, it's been a pleasure for me talking about all this with you too and sharing it.
Oh, it's lovely. Yeah, fantastic. Thanks ever so much, Teo. I will catch up with you very soon.
Cool. See ya.
Oh, I could have spoken to Teo all day. We're such good mates, but, you know, an incredible story. In fact, I've never really had the opportunity to, we've just never gone there in the conversation, actually, to go that much deeper on his life experience and kind of what makes him him. And that's the thing with our life experiences. They do carve us, as he was saying, that, you know, that they form our future. And when that happens when you're very young, then it has a greater impact as opposed to when things happen when you're older. I think when things happen when you're older, you are being more carved more sort of quickly in a way. But either way, everything has a future impact, and every loss changes you significantly and sets you onto a new path. And that's not always a bad thing, you know, that often can be a good thing and takes you onto areas that you would never have dreamed of venturing. So we just don't know what is around the corner and what purpose it's going to serve in our lives. Now, in the podcast extras, I'm going to put the full version of the theme tune that Teo wrote for this program, because it is a very beautiful piece of music. So you will find that in Podcast Extras. And if you would like to join Podcast Extras, because now there is a huge library of resources that you will find very, very helpful on your healing journey and on your journey of transformation. To join Podcast Extras, just head over to www.thegoodgriefconversation.com, and there's a bright yellow button. You just click on that, the one that says Podcast Extras, and you can sign up. Now, if you would like to support this broadcast, then of course tell all your friends and come and find us on Facebook. You'll find us at The Good Grief Conversation on Facebook, and the same on Instagram. So you can come and join us and come and like our things and learn from more resources available on there. But also, I've set up the Podcast Extras where you could make a small donation if you wish to. And one of them is for the price of a paperback book, and the other is the price of a hardback book. Now, of course, this material is always available for free, because the most important thing is that it's there to help others heal and transform their life journey. So just head over to thegoodgriefconversation.com and sign sign up for our podcast extras and all those amazing resources. So that's where you're going to find the full version of the theme tune that has been written by Teo for this program. It has been my absolute pleasure to be with you this afternoon and share my good friend Teo Akinbody with you. I'm Janet Jones, your host for the Good Grief Conversation here on UK Health Radio. I will be here again next week with more amazing guests, more amazing conversation, and I look forward to speaking to you then. In the meantime, if there's anything you wish to ask me or you want to connect for any reason at all, then do drop me an email at janet@thegoodgriefconversation.com. Right, I'm heading off now. It's been an absolute pleasure. Until next time, stay safe, stay happy, and take care of yourself. Bye for now. Speak to you soon.